The message today takes us back to the book of Revelation. Unveiling. The difficulty of preaching on the book of Revelation is the clock. It's always been the problem. I got one staring me in the face. In fact, if you think I'm looking that way regularly because of the monitor, you're wrong. It's a clock right there. And if I seem to glare that direction, it doesn't mean I have anything to do in anger with the people on each side of the clock. I hate the clock. Most misunderstandings about the book of Revelation come from treating it piecemeal. You will never understand the book of Revelation without gestalting it, as I so often use the word, gestalt learning theory, or as we translate it in psychology, field theory, in contrast to the traditional learning theories which taught people to memorize piece by piece, like building a brick wall, brick by brick. Field theory, or gestalt learning theory, throws the whole wad at you, the whole field. And though your mental processes may at times just sort of fold up and try to shield from the amount that's hitting you, there comes a point, this theory of learning postulates, that an insight comes and you begin to, all of a sudden, something integrates it. And though you may not have all of the details, you have a grasp of the whole with a controlling, insightful understanding. And then with that insight or gestalt, you then can spend the rest of your learning time on that subject, fill it, the details in. I embrace that theory of learning, adopted it many years ago, and have geared my teaching style accordingly. And you that have listened over the many years know each time we start on a new area of subject matter, your first reactions are a kind of confusion, shell shock, at the amount of material hitting in. People are breaking their pencil tips, trying to listen word for word. And you give it up. You start listening to the whole, and you see me come back Sunday after Sunday, and to the casual listener appear to be dealing with the same things, but I'm really encircling the same corral and filling it with some of the old and some additional until the insight comes to where you have a grasp or a grip or a gestalt feel for it. Then ever after, you're not as easily led astray by the piecemeal building block teachers who will pick a verse out of context, like, "I come as a thief in the night." Well, that's said in two places, with a different person being the one who says, "I come." Or like the man on the white horse. It is Jesus coming on a white horse in Revelation 19. But it's the substitute deliverer, Antichrist, coming on a white horse in Revelation 6 when the first seal is opened. Or it's like teaching on the rapture. The Thessalonian letter makes it clear that the Antichrist cannot be revealed until the restraining force, which is the church, is moved out of the way. But then you find some who are caught up into heaven, named in the book of Revelation, who obviously went through a part of the tribulation and are martyred. And you can get confused trying to figure out, well, when does the rapture take place? Well, the rapture doesn't exist. A rapture of the church, or the rapture of the church, does exist. But there's no such thing as the rapture, because there are many raptures. There were raptures when Christ came out of the grave. The book of Matthew describes many saints that had died in faith and are covered by the work of Christ that rose at the same time Christ rose. Some of them were seen in and around Jerusalem, and they were caught up then. And if you're looking for a makeup of the 24 elders, some of them at that rapture are included in the 24 elders who were men, who were on earth, who sing a song of the redeemed and obviously are not angels and did not pre-exist Adam's race and are part of the redeemed out of Adam's race. Well, some of them, if not all, were raptured when Christ was raised. The church must be removed at the appearing in the sky and the dead in Christ raised before Antichrist can be revealed. And yet there are other raptures, and without getting ahead of my lesson today, I will say at the very least, the last two witnesses that I believe are Moses and Elijah, though Enoch is also a candidate, the three who did not taste death as we know it, that God has a special purpose for, having taken both of them, Enoch and Elijah, and having sent Michael to wrestle over the body of Moses, as the Epistle of Jude describes. I think it's Moses and Elijah, but they certainly, after the days of being viewed in the streets, which could not have happened until satellite television came on the scene, they are going to be raptured and caught up. So a gestalt is needed. To understand where the 144,000 come from, you have to have a gestalt of the two sticks of the houses of Israel that Ezekiel 37 talks about. And when you understand the house of Israel consists of the birthright nation of the sons of Joseph that we spent so much time following, the so-called lost tribes, as well as the Jew of the kingdom of Judah, which comprised Levi, Benjamin, and Judah, and that these two sticks before the so-called great Russian chapters of Ezekiel 38 and 39 begin to unfold. In the 37th chapter, these two identifiable sticks must come together, the house of Joseph and the house of Judah, and Judah must march to the house of Israel, and together they go back to that promised land, which we overlook in this broadcast today from Mount Hermon, Israel. And this union that we see in these last days, no matter how much some people try, cannot be dissolved between Britain, the United States, and Israel will together comprise that vast body of the House of Israel and the tribes of Israel, out of which the 144,000 will be marked and separated out in the book of Revelation. Until you have this whole gestalt, and I add one more piece to this introduction, without the book of Daniel and his 70 weeks, and Paul's writings, particularly Romans 9, 10, and 11, you cannot comprehend that the church is a wild olive branch grafted on the nation to whom Christ turned when his own received him not. These will be caught up, and then God will finish the task of the original stock of the olive tree of Abram's faith, and the feast days, as Paul says, have the prophetic significance that demand that those that have not received Christ, on whom the affliction necessary for atonement fell, must have that wrath of God fall on them, that they might be forced to see him whom they have pierced. And after having falsely been led into the trap of accepting the rulership of Antichrist, saved in the battle of Armageddon by the true Messiah, they will enter into the fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles for 1,000 years, called millennium. Without these broad gestalts, you're never going to understand the book of Revelation, and without a gestalt of the book itself, you will be misled by isolated verses. For example, and I'm into the book of Revelation now, after that introduction, the key to the book is chapter 1, verse 19. Now, if you don't care to know these things, fine, be surprised. Because the things in this book are very nigh. I'll put parenthetically another comment. If you haven't crossed the hurdle to where you accept God's power, the reality of demon forces, the conflict of the ages between those forces of which, in which we are simply foot soldiers and demonstrative elements by which God will show forth his victory over the world, the flesh, and the devil. And if you do not accept miracles, you're wasting your time reading the book of Revelation. Go back to the foundation of Christian faith and settle the resurrection. Once you settle the resurrection, the rest is pretty easy. If you don't believe the resurrection, quit kidding yourself that you're a Christian. And I'm not talking about some cheap, occasional mental affirmation to a creed that has no heart-gripping reality to you. If you do not believe that Christ raised him up from the dead, that the Creator of the universe, who put these elements in motion, has no trouble with molecular displacement, he can do it without the explosion we get, through that rock, through locked doors, sailed off with the promise that he would come again, if you haven't crossed that hurdle, you're wasting your time studying the book of Revelation. Revelation does not debate the miraculous and the supernatural. It assumes it at the outset. John is alone on an island, banished, imprisoned. And he sees a miraculous appearance, staggering in its appearance, of the Lord Himself. He then hears the message in the 19th verse, write the things which thou hast seen. He'd just seen them, and he did it. And the things which are, which will start in the second chapter with the church of Ephesus, and the things which shall be hereafter. And once he finishes with the part of chapters 2 and 3 that deal with the nature of the churches that existed then, and goes beyond to the prophecy pattern of the churches that closes as chapter 3 ends. And he says in the 22nd verse, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Thereafter, what he writes is future to John the Revelator. The first thing that happens is the removal of the church, because the rest of the book is going to deal, for the most part, with what we've taught and called Daniel's 70th week, the church being caught up. There remains 7 years in the prophecy of Daniel 9 of the things that he would do to Daniel's people, the Jew, and to Daniel's city, Jerusalem. The church age, so to speak, will close with the catching away of the church, symbolized by John, who is the only living member of the church present on the Isle of Patmos as the revelation is unfolding. He is caught up. And for 2 chapters, there is a parenthesis of scenes in heaven. I'd like you to notice something. Verse 6 of the 4th chapter. Before the throne there was a sea of glass, like unto crystal. And in the midst of the throne and round about the throne, he describes creatures of interest, but not the subject today. Notice the sea of glass, no people on it. The only persons, in order that I might include people and heavenly beings, are around the throne. The sea of glass is there, but there's nobody. On it. Let's go over a ways and see this sea of glass again. Go to chapter 15, first verse. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, 7 angels having the 7 last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass having the harps of God. And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are thy works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee? For thou only art holy, for all nations shall come and worship before thee. And for the judgments are made manifest. Notice that these are people that had gotten the victory over the beast, gotten the victory over his image, which means they would not bow down to it, had gotten the victory over his mark, which means they would not take the mark of the beast, and over the number of his name, refusing to be stamped with 666, Am I boring you?
No,
go back to the 13th chapter. It's talking of the false prophet who looks like a lamb, has all the appearance of a spokesman for Christ, verse 11. But when he opens his mouth, you know where he gets his message, this false prophet, speaking as a dragon, none other than the voice of the harlot woman that we'll encounter in the symbol of the beast in two other chapters. And it is this false prophet who looks like Christ but gets his message from Satan, that verse 16 says, he, not the Antichrist, but rather the false religious leader, causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. And here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 600, 66. 666. We go to one other passage. You hanging in there? Everybody cough. Now, one more time to get it done. One more for the holdouts. Now, maybe you can get by a little while without coughing. This book proceeds, as I'm working toward showing you the gestalt of the book, through seven seals opened by Christ, seven trumpets blown by seven angels, and seven vials poured out by seven angels. These, most if not all, occur in the first 3.5 years of the 7-year Daniel 70th week, which is the tribulation, the great tribulation, to distinguish it from just ordinary tribulation, because this is God's wrath being poured out, His church having been removed, and atonement occurring through affliction is going to be rendered out on this earth. And the first 3.5 years encompass most of these signs, though it gets a little gray about halfway through these trumpets. But certainly, as you finish the seventh trumpet and start the vials, you have the intensified, terrible tribulation, the great, bringing history to consummation. During these seals, go back to chapter 6. I love to hear the pages turn. The first seal, Antichrist, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Antichrist. Then comes the red horse of war. That was the white horse. Then comes the black horse of famine. Then the pale horse of death. As four seals are opened. The fifth seal. And I would call these to give them a name. Not original with me. Others have done this. The church is caught up as the raptured saints. Now, what's a saint? One who gives himself utterly and completely to God, right? Now, the raptured saints, the church, pre-trib. They go up, Revelation 4:1. You see them periodically in the parenthesis scenes of heaven. You want me to teach this book? I want to be sure. Because it's pretty heavy stuff. Are we ready? Now please do not watch Christian television other than me for the next 6 months. Because you will see a rash of prophecy preachers that quit back where I quit, that now will pick up their notes and proceed about 1 or 2 weeks behind me. But they will be continually going off on blind, dead-end side roads, trying to take what I'm doing and finish it before I finish it. How many have seen that? I mean, man, television is going to be loaded with prophecy preachers for the next few months, running on a time delay. And I know that's why God on occasions has me interrupt and put in one of my 7 messages every year. Because they will put out ads on what they're going to do the following Sunday, and then I'll throw them a curve and get off of Revelation for a week or two. And they don't know what to do. Now these pre-trib raptured saints, which is the church, there are some other pre-trib raptured saints. That are pre-church, pre-church rapture, and pre-trib raptured saints. Go ahead and read when you go home the last chapters following the resurrection and the Gospels. And you will find the references there. Read all 4 Gospels. The scenes described in and around Jerusalem after the resurrection of Christ. I mean, if there's any sanctuary of faith, any universal acceptance of the Christian message, it is in the Gospels. Well, you read the first 7 chapters of Mark, and you'll see what the Gospels have to say concerning the reality of demons. Because Jesus meets one or more about everywhere he goes in those first 7 chapters of Mark, including in a synagogue, where none of the rest of the holy ones there even recognize his presence. And read the gospel record following the resurrection, and you will find when Christ came out of the tomb, other saints were resurrected too. So I got at least 2 raptures already. This one should be 1. And this one should be 2. And then if I want to take Enoch, now he was before the flood, maybe he's 1. And then if I want to take Elijah, who went up in what I think was a UFO, so he wasn't raptured in the normal sense, but he certainly was taken away. Then Philip, in the book of Acts, was raptured horizontal from the Gaza Strip to Jerusalem. So don't give me your silly little boxes and ask me to tell God you can't move them around unless it's this one time. He moves whom he will, where he will, up, down, and round, and sideways. That's why you need to settle the resurrection issue. I can remember being in a bookstore over in Westwood UCLA's headquarters, and I begin to think I had a nut. I'd get behind the bookshelves. I've told you this before, but it fits again right now. And I'm looking for some books, and I see this college kid. Everywhere I go, he's on the other side of the bookstore looking at me, bookshelf looking at me. Did you ever see the movie What's Up, Doc? Huh? I remember the Jewish singer, whatever her name is, appearing at, Who? Barbara Streisand appearing at, who's the other guy? Who? Ryan O'Neill, that's it. The guy who had trouble with his igneous rocks. Geologist, mineralogist or something. Taxi cab hit a bump in San Francisco and lets out a scream, and the taxi driver says, "What's the matter?" He said, "My igneous rocks had fallen off the seat into the floor," and the taxi driver says, "I have trouble with mine too." Now, Jerry Falwell would never weave things like that into his message. Well, you remember when Ryan O'Neill was in, I think it was a drugstore, and everywhere he went, Barbara Streisand was peering at him? Well, I started getting nervous. Bad enough to be peered at by the opposite sex. Over in... This kid was really getting to me. Finally, I walked around the end of one of the bookshelves, and he said to me, "Do you really believe those things you're talking about on television?" And that was during one of the past times when I was teaching on this subject. And I said to him, and I say to you, absolutely. I don't have any trouble with this. Once I cross the resurrection hurdle, that's why Christianity seems so futile to me. Of those that sort of wave at it, but will not settle once for all in their spirit the resurrection. Right now, as always, there's a new wave of attention to miracles. In the New Testament, miracles were not what was shocking. It was the grace of God and forgiveness of sins that shattered them. Miracles sort of taken for granted, as they ought to be, if you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So sure I believe this is going to happen. Sure I believe Elijah was caught up. Sure I believe Enoch was caught up. No harder to believe that God can raise up other saints than to believe that He raised up Jesus from the dead. At least the other saints didn't have a Roman guard on their grave. What's the big deal? So I've got now one, if we count Enoch, Elijah's two. I've got the resurrection of Christ, pre-church, pre-trib rapture, that's three. I got four of them. And that may not exhaust them by the time I get to Revelation 4:1, where the church is caught up in order that it might not be subject to the wrath of God. We're not appointed under wrath, but to obtain salvation through Jesus Christ. And He must suffer only once. I've said this many times. Moses did not miss the promised land because he lost his temper. It was not his anger that kept him out. He was equally angry, indeed, I think more angry, when he came down from Mount Sinai. There he was so mad he broke the tablets of stone, written with God's finger. Slew 3,000 in one day. Broke their golden calf, ground it to powder, made soup out of it, and made the Israelites eat it. And as I've often said, I'm sure there was one in that band that tried to get the franchise on the outside toilets for a month because of... You won't get that from Jerry Falwell either. His anger there, he then offered himself to God for judgment, and God said, him that sins I'll punish, Galloway. Because his anger served God's revelatory purpose. And when God chose Abram and his descendants to be his oracle, he made them his oracle in spite of themselves. And as the controller of history, he would use their mistakes and bend their lifestyle and patterns of activity like a director in control of a drama on the stage of history with real life actors. He would make their life dramatize his truth. And Moses' anger in this case served God's revelation because it enabled the demonstration in dramatic reality that God's law first given, written by God, was broken in the hands of men. And the law reproduced, second time, is kept only inside the Ark of the Covenant, the type of Christ. And when he came down the mountain, as the law was given, there was a harvest of death, which is all that the law can bring, 3,000 at the end of that day. When redemption comes, grace is poured out, and the Spirit of life comes on the day of Pentecost, there's a harvest of life as 3,000 are born into the kingdom in one day. So Moses' anger served God's purpose. But in the book of Numbers, after the rock had been smitten at Rephidim and the water poured forth, Christ was to be smitten once. In the book of Numbers, as they're murmuring with no water, God says to Moses, speak to the rock, and the water will come forth. In anger, he screamed at the people, you rebels, and he struck the rock. He could have screamed at them all day and nothing would have happened. But because he struck the rock, the type of Christ, his anger put him in contradiction with God's revelatory drama, and he paid a supreme penalty for that. It wasn't his anger, per se. It was his anger was used to interfere with God's revelation, and the punishment on Moses is God entering into the drama to teach graphically that the body of Christ is to be smitten once and only once with the rod of judgment. And that's why the church, which is the body of Christ, must go up before the wrath of God is poured out. That rapture takes them up. But now as we move into the tribulation and Christ has opened the seals and the four horsemen have passed by, ninth verse. When he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. Now there was nothing, nobody, on the sea of glass in the fourth chapter. Now in the sixth chapter, we got souls under the altar that are martyrs. The church has gone up. So these are martyrs between the church being gone and the first seal being opened in 6:1 through the fourth seal. Now we encounter already some souls in a state of suspension, the closest thing you'll find in Scripture to the Catholic idea of purgatory, but it's too late by then. The church is already gone. These are in a holding pattern. Souls under the altar, and they cry out. with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, which means that these slain souls have some substance of reality. And it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also, and their brethren that should be killed as they were, should be fulfilled. These clusters, after the earnest of God's rapturing power is shown in Enoch and Elijah, these clusters tend to complete as groups. Old Testament saints make it to heaven not because they kept the law. Romans 4 makes that clear. Don't look to Abraham as though he made it in because he kept the law. It was his faith. And Paul doesn't need to elaborate much. We know Abraham was a liar. We know that he certainly couldn't get on a deacon board with his performance with Hagar, in spite of the fact his wife approved. If Abraham was saved by works, you could fill a church promoting his works. You know, the church of the lying ones and the bleep around ones. Los Angeles would pack a church out like that. His faith got him in. Don't say David got in by his works. Adulterer, liar, murderer. His faith got him in. Jesus preached to departed souls the gospel the 3 days he was in the grave. And when he came out of the grave, there is a lot to support the view that all these Old Testament saints whose faith took them in went up with Christ at his resurrection. But whether all of them or some of them, there's a lot to support, and I lean toward the all of them view, though I think it's one of those questions to be settled ultimately over there. That lends support to the idea that that which some church Christians count on as their way of making it to heaven will likewise accumulate during the Great Tribulation. There will be those who wake up to the truth. The 144,000 that are selected will preach the truth. Hopefully some of my tapes will still be playing. And maybe Pat Robinson will wake up. Because he says the church will go through the tribulation, and I can assure him that he and any who believe that will. And it's nonsense to think the Holy Spirit is gone. He's still here, empowering the two witnesses to pick the most graphic example. And there will be people who wake up during the tribulation to the truth and the warnings that have been preached and will recognize Antichrist for what he is, the false prophet for what he is. Most of these will respond out of the Jewish and the Israeli nations, but not all. Out of every ethnic group will be some who hear and recognize that Antichrist is exactly that Antichrist, and the false prophet is exactly that false prophet, and they will refuse. And they will pay with their heads. They'll be martyred. Now, I give the name as I said earlier, others have also given the name to these souls under the altar as the lesser tribulation saints. Because the full orb tribulation has not yet occurred, not even the last four trumpets have occurred, or the last, not even any of the trumpets have occurred by this time. So early on in the tribulation, these represent martyrs to faith who missed the tribulation. They're not raptured. They're in a waiting state, and they're complaining about it. They get the earnest of their inheritance, the white robes, but they are to wait until others accumulate who are exactly as they are. Tribulation saints who refuse the rule of Antichrist and pay with their life. Now, maybe that's the way you prefer to go. Now, I've heard that nonsense since I was a kid. Well, if I miss the rapture, I'll give my head. People who couldn't drive to the cathedral on Sunday are going to give their head. Give me a break. People who won't pay tithe are going to give their head. Am I boring you? I ain't boring me. And these souls under the altar that gave their life do it after he sees the sea of glass in the fourth chapter that had nobody on it. Right? And we encounter the first lesser tribulation saints who gave their life being told as the fifth seal is opened to reveal their martyrdom and their temporary waiting or holding tank for eternity. And they're crying out for vengeance, and they get the message, you wait until others who pay the same price you pay join you. And we know that several join as the week and the seals and trumpets and vials begin to flow. And we come again, I'll take you back to the 15th chapter. I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. Those who have had their faith tried in the fire. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast, over his image, and over his mark. There's only one way you get the victory over the beast, over his image, over his mark, and over his number. You pay with your head. You don't get the victory running from him. You get the victory the way martyred saints of the first century got the victory. The choice, take the mark of the beast or pay with your head. Now, by the time we get to chapter 15, this sea of glass is peopled. Them that had gotten the victory over the beast, over his image, over his mark, and over the number of his name stand on the sea of glass, having the hearts of God, and they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are thy works. So we have the souls that are here, and the other martyrs that they wait for and who join them through this tribulation also now raptured or caught up. And the empty sea of glass that was waiting for them in that grand finale of history, they are there to sing the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb, which immediately classifies them as subjects or objects of redemption, thus not angels, who are singing a song that angels cannot sing, and they represent the martyred saints throughout the tribulation. Go on. Can I continue? The sixth seal. 12th verse, 6th chapter, I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. The stars of heaven fell unto the earth. Even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind, and the heaven departed as a scroll when it's rolled together. And every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath, again why it's called the tribulation, the great tribulation, because it's the wrath of God, or the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? There's a parenthesis then before the seventh seal is opened. And I think I'm going to bring a series of my original paintings and put them on display here next Sunday, because I've painted through this silence in heaven. Well, a few of you want to see it. That's nice. Good too. Hold it. I'm running out of time. I have painted the Revelation series, as you recall, through silence in the heavens and the black sackcloth sun. So I think I'll bring it next Sunday, but depends on whether we can put it together and find the places and display it properly with the lights. If not, I certainly will before I finish this series. So now the parenthesis. After these things, and before the seventh seal, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. Now, a lot of people wonder why the whole earth seems to be getting more and more unstable. It took this generation to recognize that this earth is made up of plates that are drifting on its surface. And most people who study geology know that India represents a plate pushing up and forcing the Himalaya Mountains to buckle up because of that plate that's pushing northward, representing the continent or the continent extension of India. And we're seeing this old world doing a lot of unusual shaking. We're seeing catastrophes in nature like I can't remember in my short life, all crashing in over this last decade. Well, cheer up. It's going to get worse. But the angels are going to stay everything for a moment. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And I heard the number of them which were sealed. And there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Now, to the Jehovah's Witness who come to call on you and want to talk to you, say, I have a tape of my pastor I want you to listen to, and you put this message on. Because when they come to tell you about God making up his 144,000 now, You tell him they're a bit early, and you appreciate very much their desire to be part of the 144,000, but if they aren't from the right race, forget it. That's number one. If they can't trace their descendancy to these ethnic groups, forget it. And number two, you're going to be gone. You're going to be gone. You're going to be gone because this ain't happening until after the sixth seal. Until after Antichrist is already in power. This happens after the sixth seal is pulled off. And out of all the tribes, well now, you may also wonder how he's going to get all these out of the nation Israel. He won't. That's why the teaching on the lost tribes is so important to an understanding of the book of Revelation. When you understand the lost tribes were never lost, when you understand that the sons of Joseph got the birthright, and Judah, from whom the Jews come, got the scepter and the right to make the law, and that these sons of Joseph dominated by Ephraim, this house of Israel, so-called lost tribes, is none other than the Celtic nations that by progressive waves swept across northwestern Europe to concentrate in the British Isles and in Ireland before they jumped the Atlantic to be the real discoverers of this North American continent, you then know that worldwide God will have a quota from which He will build this 144,000. He will put a seal on them, capable of being seen, not only by man, but by demon forces that are going to be unleashed very shortly. And one tribe is left out. Dan, and the question, some people will not even study the book of Revelation past this point unless they get an answer. Why isn't Dan included? Because God chose not to choose them. End of subject. Nobody will ever tell you why Dan was not chosen. I can give you a hint. Their prophetic role, Dan will judge his people. A judge does something besides condemn. A judge certifies. In fact, maybe the most important continuous job of the judge is to certify. The jury usually does the condemning. The judge certifies this exhibit as real or not real and acceptable. He stamps, he seals. Now the word Dan means to judge. Jordan is spreading judgment. Literally, if the English did not fight against the same word twice in the same sentence, the proper translation of the prophecy regarding Dan is, judge shall judge his people. Because that's what Dan means. Or Dan will Dan his people. Because the mark of Dan is the mark of judgment. And God puts a little clue in His Word of the characteristic activity of Dan, wherever they went. They didn't like the little piece of territory in the southern part of Israel. So they went and conquered a city. And when they conquered the city, they put their name on it. It formerly was known as Luz, and it became thereafter known as Dan. And it seems to be that the prophetic role of Dan was to seal and mark the journey of the lost tribes wherever they went. Now, there's no vowels in the Hebrew, or rather consonants. And you have to imply from the context, later years they add signs for vowels, but literally, Dan is simply D-N, two consonants, which means it could be Dan, done, then, gone. But then, and as you trace the role of the Celts, the river Don, Dnieper, the Danube, Macedonia. Ultimately, you can go clear into the Dunns of Ireland. You can find that mark in the little nation jutting out into the northwest, Dan's mark. And their judgment roll may have been concluded, and they can go with these other saints of faith, but that's sheer speculation. God has a right to choose whom He will. Jacob He loves, Esau He hates. 144,000 doesn't include Dan. End of subject. Don't look for them anywhere else because they aren't there. He didn't put them in the 144,000. They are marked because when He had opened the seventh seal, chapter 8, there was silence in heaven for the space of a half an hour. Then seven angels appeared before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. The first trumpet blows in verse 7. Second trumpet blows in verse 8. Third trumpet blows in verse 10. Fourth trumpet in verse 12. I want to take up with these trumpets next Sunday. But after the four trumpets, I want to end on this note. I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound." Of the trumpets, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then an angel warning. Woe, woe, woe. If you have thought what's been happening is bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. For now, the intensified, and that's why I say it's a bit fuzzy here, whether the last three trumpets and the final seven vials represents the midpoint of the tribulation period, the middle of the week, that is identified as the time when Antichrist breaks his covenant in the book of Daniel. These last three woes, I'll let you have a taste of two of them. Fifth angel sounded, I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him, for this star is an angel, was given the key of the bottomless pit, literally in the Greek, the abyss, which demons in Mark's gospel cried to Jesus, "Are you come to send us to the abyss before our time?" The same abyss into which Satan will be cast and bound 1,000 years. Out of this abyss, demon angels have been imprisoned, and out of this abyss they come. He opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. To them was given that they should not kill men, but they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. But it was commanded in verse 4, they should not hurt the grass of the earth, any green thing, any tree, only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. God protected the 144,000 from these demon forces. He then will release 200 million demons that have been bound in the river Euphrates. You wonder why such demon forces rule in that Baghdad, Iran area. 200 million horsemen demons will be released next. Now, who are this 144,000? You'll encounter later the woman standing in the sun, none other than Israel, the nation Israel. All of it, both sticks, descendants of Jacob renamed Israel. And out of Israel will come a man-child that's been confused with Christ as the man on the white horse in Revelation 6 has been confused with Christ. The man-child is not Christ. The woman and the son is not ancient Israel, but Israel during the tribulation consisting of all the nations, out of whom also comes a group of people, the 144,000. I'll show you next Sunday that the 144,000 are none other than the man-child, synonymous as the woman represents a group of people, so does the man-child represent a group. Individuals produce individuals, groups produce groups. And the woman is Israel after the church is gone, during the tribulation, and the man-child is the 144,000 who will also be raptured. But that's my subject next week.